My name is Ray O'Keefe. I'm still an alcoholic. As they say in Texas, through the grace of God, this program, people like you, has been necessary for me to have a drink since November 24th, 1965. And the other one said, you lying bastard, you were drunk last Tuesday. He said, that's right, but it wasn't necessary. So anyhow, the book tells us when speaking, we are to tell our story in a general way about what we were like, how we came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what we are like now. And it is traditional, therefore, to start at the beginning. And I was born and raised and grew up in New York City, in one of the neighborhoods in the Bronx. And when I say I grew up, I really mean I got a little taller in that neighborhood. And it was an Irish neighborhood. Now, you may not understand it here in Georgia, but they drank in that neighborhood. You would actually see people on the street under the influence of alcohol. And this is very warping for a young mind. I found out about 4 years ago I'm from a dysfunctional family. I thought it functioned all right. We had breakfast at 7, dinner at 6, and everybody else was on their own most of the time. If you look where I live, you see a little drinking. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a drink from time to time when the pressure got on. Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits, and something would fly, usually one of the children. My brother Billy, on the other hand, was a very bad drinker, and in a neighborhood of Irish drunks, Billy stood out. So when it came my time, I don't know what age this was, I don't know. I counted from when I went into the bars, which was 14, and I went into the bars at 14, and I ordered up whatever it was they were serving the 14s that day. I guess it was a beer. I don't really remember. Beer was the neighborhood drink. But I'll tell you this, I liked it. God, I liked it. I liked everything about it. I liked the way it looked. I liked the way it smelled. I liked the way it tastes. I liked what it did for my head. I liked the noise, the smoke, the confusion, the fist fights, the Irish music. I love the bullshit. I love the bullshit. And I chased it around for the next 25 years, I guess. I was going through the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking. It's a very difficult system to go through drunk. And I was forever in trouble. I had all of the problems that anybody would have trying to go through the Catholic school system drunk. I was thrown out of high school a number of times. I held my neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously established by my brother Billy. I don't know how this happened. To this day, I haven't the slightest idea, but when I got out of high school, I ended up going to college. And not only did I go to college, I went to college in the state of Vermont, which is like going to college on the moon. A terrible culture shock. At this time, there were no bars in the state of Vermont. There were just restaurants. And people sat around the tables, and they drank beer out of bottles. And they sang college songs. And they wore white shoes in the wintertime. And being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white bucks. I learned the words to those songs. I got very collegiate. World War II was just about over. It seemed relatively safe. Things were a little slow on the campus, so one day I got a haircut and I joined the Navy. And I was assigned to a minesweeper out in San Francisco. I hate to be indelicate on a Sunday morning, but I have to tell you that I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept three to a tier, Hey, lady, don't, please, don't get ahead of me. This is not an easy thing. I'm very weird. Very tired. He throw my timing right in the desk. And a new guy slept on top. So I come back from that First Liberty in San Francisco with all the beer and me I can buy. And I met the fellow that slept below me that night. I guess he figured he'd be wet sometime during his naval career. It hadn't occurred to him what happened while he was sleeping. I was immediately transferred to a lower bunk. The rest of my naval career was just as distinguished, and I came home undecorated, unhonored, unloved. When it was all over, back to the neighborhood, and everything was under control in the neighborhood. The widow was out in the weeds somewhere. My brother Billy was missing from the New York City Police Department. Billy had some misunderstanding with a citizen of the Puerto Rican ancestry who flew off a five-story roof and bounced and lived to identify the Irish cop. So Billy went west and went into a more, he went into a more peaceful line of work. He went back in the Marine Corps. The government was giving veterans $20 a week for 52 weeks. I qualified for the 5220 Club. I got my check. I gravitated to the local bar, of course, and I got my check, and I was drinking up my check every week with a couple of my grammar school classmates who were starting a stolen car ring, and I thought perhaps I would be of some executive talent for them in their stolen car enterprise. And we were planning the future of petty crime. And I remembered, at one of those great moments of clarity that come from time to time to people of great minds, and I remembered I'd been to college. Forgot it there for a while. So I got on the bus and I went back up there. And I arrived in the middle of a blizzard, and I went into this place, and there they were, sitting around a table, drinking beer out of a bottle, singing those songs, wearing those shoes. So I got another pair of shoes, and now a grateful government was sending me a check every month and was paying my tuition, so I was moderately solvent and therefore fairly drunk most of the time. And one day I was staying around the campus in my usual shape, and I saw a list of names on a bulletin board of people who were qualified to graduate, and my name was on the list. And that was excellent news. I thought I had another year to go. I don't know where time goes. It just flies. You know? So I called up the widow and announced this great event. And the widow came north for the graduation. That was a very, very tender occasion. The widow O'Keefe and her youngest child staggering around under the elms. About 10 years later, I was on the board of that school, and they were still talking about my mother. It's not often in the state of Vermont they see a little old lady get off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning and start a fist fight with somebody. So I got back home to the neighborhood, and my uncles, we're very Irish. My uncles ran everything because they were my uncles. My father was dead. My uncles ran everything because they worked. And they were Irish. And they voted unanimously that I become a New York City policeman. Because that's what my father had done. That's what my brother had done. And that's what all of them were doing. All my uncles and cousins were cops, except for the two morons that worked for the telephone company. But that's another story. So I told them that I was going to law school and that I wasn't going to be a cop. I made up my own mind what to do, and I was going to go to law school. And I'd be unemployed for the next several years. So they received that with mixed emotions, and that's what I did. I'm off to law school. I never met a lawyer. I never saw a lawyer before I went to law school. We didn't have any lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops, and we had priests. We really didn't need any lawyers. I hate to be disloyal to the profession that's done so well for me, but I'll tell you, when I got to law school, I found I was in the company of the greatest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. God, they were deadly. They all had on a blue suit and they wore eyeglasses. So I got into uniform and I found a pair of glasses that I didn't need, and I walked around wearing glasses. And I looked around for somebody to drink with, but nobody drank in this crowd. They were all students. They were all studying. They were all grinding it out. So that's what I did. I went on the wagon, stopped drinking, and became the biggest grind they ever had in that place. As a result of that, when I graduated, I was taken into a lodge, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. It was not a total loss, however. I did learn to say, "Oh, really," instead of "No shit." Can I get some of that? Nice. Yeah, I say, "Oh, really? Huh, that's very nice. Oh, yes, really? Yeah." My superiors had determined that I should be trained as a trial lawyer, and so I was sent up to the courthouse in Manhattan in New York City to learn my business. And I was only there a couple of days when I found out that all the brilliant people were across the street in a saloon. So I moved my office into the saloon, and I learned to drink in a different, more civilized, more genteel fashion. Very few members of the profession were knocking down shots and beers where anybody could see them. I discovered scotch in a tall glass with water, and you sip on that. It takes a little while, but it gets the job done. I discovered all of the mysteries and all of the rituals that surround a very, very dry martini. And to this morning and to this minute, thank you. My love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal to these things, and it was necessary. They almost killed me. Well, it came time for me to be married. And I'm really beholden to last night's speaker for reminding me of the joy of that occasion. It was natural in natural development that I should be married. I had located Stephanie, or she had located me. Who knows how these things work? I was a bellhop in a hotel, and she was a guest. And that pretty well characterizes the relationship right now. As Stephanie told you, she's from a very nice family with a nice house and a nice neighborhood, etc. They were nice. I will not burden you with the details of my wedding day. But I assure you that when the O'Keefes from the South Bronx hit the Westchester Country Club, we set a few records. We then settled down, and Stephanie began to produce children with the regularity that is known only to the Roman Catholic. And we measure things by children, at least I do. Around the time of the second child, I received a call from the law school. I attended the Fordham University School of Law in New York City. It's a big Jesuit university, and it's an old established law school, very good law school. And I was invited to become a member of the faculty, and they appointed me as a professor of law. I was 26, I guess, or 27. And I knew that I drank too much. I knew that much. So I decided I would drink less because I was nervous about, you know, what the hell is there in my background that becomes a professor of law. And it made me very, very nervous to think I'd have a class this big and start talking about constitutional law. Jesus. So I decided I would drink less. So I ended up drinking more while I was drinking less, so I wouldn't drink more so I could drink less and not be fired for drinking more. If that makes a lot of sense to you, because I know nothing makes a lot of sense to you. You're too far gone. Mister. So there I was, the boy professor, and I'm trying not to drink, and it's going no place. But what happened was, it turned out, the way things happen, as I am, I turned out to be a competent teacher. I'm a good teacher. I was a good teacher. And once I found that out, what the hell do I have to stop drinking? And why am I drinking more? Well, I'm drinking less and drinking more. I might as well go out and drink more, right? And I only knew one way how to drink. I didn't have a father. I had my older brother, Billy. I tried to do everything like Billy. If you saw Billy and me, you'd not think us brothers. He was big, rugged Marine, and I'm a little, you know, fatso. Student is what I was. And so I wanted to be just like Billy. I wanted to be a hero like Billy. And I just didn't have the equipment to do it, you know. It wasn't physical. I had no coordination, all that stuff. All I was smart. But I drank like Billy. I drank until I fell down, or that place went on fire, or I set it on fire, or the cops showed up. Well, I never stopped until I, you know, was stopped. And so I just started drinking that way again. And we had it up to, I don't know what, 5 children, 6 children, 7 children. Who the hell knows? We had a lot of children. I mean, there you see them. They're in the house. They're all over the place. I mean, God, little beady eyes. They're all over. Reeking of milk and pablum and looking cute, you'd be like killing them. But that's another story. I might be responsible for a dysfunctional family. If you can find a functional family somewhere, let me know. Well, yeah, I want to go see one. Don't get me started on that shit. I'm just barely getting over and keeping in touch with my emotions. I'll tell you what you ought to do, gang. You don't worry about keeping in touch. You better keep in touch with your sponsor or your ass is going to fall off. You know? So anyhow, here I am with Professor O'Keefe. I'm 3 or 4 years into the job. I have 5, 6, 7 children, whatever I got. We're in a nice home in a nice village called Larchmont, New York. Very Tony kind of a place with a lot of people with blue blazers and plaid pants, you know, that kind of stuff. I'm whooping it up, and I'm drunk every single day and all night, and I'm up at 3 in the morning drinking. I decided to study French. The sunrise semester came out around 6. I'd sit there with an old bottle of warm vodka studying French, you know. Anything just to take my mind off the fact that I was drunk 24 hours a day, and I was staying out nights and wandering around the city. I was also a consultant to a law firm. I'd drop in and steal. I was stealing money from a law firm so I could drink, and I was cutting classes. Let me tell you something. A full professor of law who was tenured, here's my schedule. I work 6 hours a week, 32 weeks a year. I could not handle it. It was too much. It's just so much a human can do. You understand? So I was not showing up when I was supposed to show up, or I'd show up drunk. And one thing was leading to the other. It was getting pretty bad. And Mrs. O'Keefe, oh, mother, you won't believe this. You will not believe this. Miss O'Keefe started, she was talking ugly about me. She said to me, you're not even going to believe this. What she said to me, you know what she said to me? I'll tell you. She said to me, there is something radically wrong with the way you drink. You see, Miss O'Keefe does not have the benefit of a legal education. She is not an attorney. So I had to explain things to her, which I did. I explained to her, I want you to follow along with this, the relativity of drinking, which is to say that some people drink more than other people. Are we all right so far? Thank you. And then I would say to her, on a relative scale, I really don't drink so much. As a matter of fact, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks as much as... What is a person to do? What is, you know, I had to go see Mom. She had, she had insulted my mother. I had to go see Mom. I go over and really do a job. I go see Mom. So this was driving her crazy. And she betook herself to her physician, who, as you might imagine, is an obstetrician. And he could find nothing the matter with her until she told him about me. And that solved the problem with her, and he sent her home to me with a message. I am one of the few men in Alcoholics Anonymous who come here upon the advice of a gynecologist. Because her message was that her doctor, the obstetrician, had diagnosed her husband, the law professor, as an alcoholic. Oh, I was outraged to hear this shit. I rose to defend myself, as is my custom, and I took a very, very dim view of a physician who would diagnose a patient without ever seeing the patient. I was against that shabby type of medical practice, all too common in our country today. And then I went into high gear and I asked Ms. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. And I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. You got it. And at this point, the conversation was coming down at a terrible rate. And then it happened. I don't know how this happened. It happened. I cannot explain how this happened. I can explain everything else to you, and I probably will in the second or third hour of this terrific talk that I am giving here. But in the middle of all of this, I stopped. And I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe, for the first time I had ever admitted to anyone, that there was at least the possibility that I drank too much sometimes. This was a very serious tactical error. 3 days later, I was in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. And I was only there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. And I was overcome with outrage and self-pity, and I rose and I screamed. And in addition to everything else happening bad, it was the occasion of my 35th birthday. I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was hanging around, and I very carefully explained to that cretin that on that very day I had attained age 35. And therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents in residence. Washington and Jefferson were there. And he gave me some foul substance, and then he disappeared for a week or two. And I woke up about a week later and came to and sat up and took a little nourishment and demanded to see the head of the hospital because that's the way I am. And, of course, he showed up and he fixed his cool, professional eyes upon me. And he asked me that question that so many people ask alcoholics. It's so stupid. He said, "Tell me, Professor, why do you drink so much?" So I told him of my wealthy parents. I said, "Mommy and Dada, I used to travel a great deal. And I've been left in the hands of cruel servants who are black. And I become insecure. So I turned to an alcohol." He was very, very sympathetic. He was an understanding and caring person. He said he had seen this before. So I said, "Well, you're seeing it again." And he went out, and about 15 minutes later, one of his colleagues came in, and he asked me the same question. I told him of my impoverished youth. I told him of the beatings I used to get from my drunken mother. I told him about the time my sister Marie stole my rubber duck and I went at her with a knife. He said help was at hand. He said I'd come to the right place. Said with his help and the help of medical science, one day I would drink safely again. I said, "Thank you, doctor." He was my kind of a doctor, that doctor. And the last doctor that came in and the last psychiatrist I've ever seen, except for one I used to take the meetings from time to time, who killed himself. But that's another story. This one came in. Yes, he popped the same question. I gave him a sexual aberration that put him right out in the hallway. And I guess if he had a great degenerate to work with, perhaps he had. What do I know? So the next day, I wasn't as smart as I thought because they had a meeting and they were talking about me. And I was brought into a room almost this size, and I was told that I was in grave danger of being expelled from a mental institution. The guy said, "You're not cooperating." So what the hell are you talking about? Now, I'm cooperating. I was cooperating. I was playing Monopoly with three guys. Who were there? They weren't alcoholics. They were just there. And we played Monopoly all day and all night. And one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. And if you know anything about the game of Monopoly, and some lunatic thinks you're his real estate broker, you do very well. And I had the boardwalk. I had a couple of hotels. And I was very, very happy with the Monopoly therapy. And I wasn't thinking about drinking. It's just as good as some of the shit they hand out in these places today. I recommend Monopoly. You want to stop drinking? Monopoly is for me, boy. So about a day later, they said, "You have a visitor." Who the hell are a visitor? Who's going to visit me? So I go into my large executive type padded cell, and I wait. And into that room comes this big, tall, imposing, well-dressed-looking guy from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous. His name was Page, and I asked Dick about him, and Dick said he's still going. This is in 1963. And he says, I say to him, "Who are you?" And I don't know this guy. And he says, "I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. The hospital has given up on you." I almost had him by the throat. I went right at him. And you won't believe, you know what this man said to me? You're not going to believe this one. You think I told you? You know what this guy said to me? Listen to this. He said, "Shut up." Just like that. I immediately forgave him. because I understood that they had neglected to tell him who I was. So it seemed appropriate that I would tell him who I was. So I stood and I began to recite my credentials. He said, "Shut up and sit down." Boy, what a rude person. I was not a well man. And he looked pretty good. I was very sick, so I sat down. He started telling me this fantastic story about him and how he got to Alcoholics Anonymous, what he was like, and what was going on with him then. Just like our book instructs us, just like I've been trying to tell you for the last half hour. And he said, "Would you like to go with me to meetings?" Meetings. What kind of meetings? He said, "Meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous." Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Where are these meetings? He said, "Outside." I said, "I'm going with you." Besides that, he gave me matches. Gave me a book of matches. Nobody else allowed me to have any matches. Matches are power, flame. Light cigarettes, matches. Very good. So that's how we went off for 1963, off on the highways and the byways of Southern Connecticut. And he was very good to me, and he made arrangements that I go locally. And, of course, I came home, and I started to go locally. And I don't remember so much all of that because I came home with this enormous jar of pills. In those days, the medical profession was of the opinion that the disease of alcoholism was being caused by some type of a Valium deficiency. And therefore, you were trying to lose with a big jar of Valium so you'd never get too low. You know, you could always keep the level up. And they said, "When you feel like drinking, have one of these." So I used to, and I'm walking around. My head is buzzing, and I'm, you know, in another world someplace. But I went to meetings. I knew myself pretty good. I thought I'd come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me your president. I was always president if I joined something. I would serve a term as your president. There'd probably be a dinner at some nice hotel, and I'd be given another plaque. I had a whole room full of them. And that would be the end of my Alcoholics Anonymous career. And that looked all right to me. Except that 10 months later, I was drunk. Drunk. Just like that, drunk. Really drunk. Drunk. Really, really drunk. Big drunk. And I was like falling off a cliff. It's hard to describe. It's even hard to remember. It was murder. Absolute murder. It was just purely murder. I would drink a week. Then I wouldn't drink a month. I'd drink a month. I wouldn't drink a week. I would drink and come to these meetings. I would come to these meetings and I would drink. I never knew when I would start drinking. I certainly never knew where I would be when I finished drinking. And things began to happen to me in this period of time that had never happened to me before. And I am not talking to you now about things that I no longer consider to be significant. I am not talking to you about the fact that I was dismissed from the faculty, fired as a tenured professor of law, and that all of the stature and all of the prestige and all of the appointments and all of the dollars that went with that position were taken from me in about 15 minutes. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was in serious, I mean very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulties. I do not even speak to you of the fact that I had disappointed and let down everybody who ever relied on me. All of this happened in this period of time, but that is not what I am speaking to you about. What I am speaking to you about is that there seems to have been, in my case, and perhaps in yours, a terrible, terrible disintegration of my spirit. That spirit which separates me from my cat and separates me even from each of you. That spirit which gives to this particular form whatever individuality or personality or character that it might have. And this was a spirit which once burned in me so bright. And it was extinguished, and I knew it. And there wasn't a thing in the world I could do about it. I had been here, and this didn't work for me. And brother, if you've been here, and this doesn't work, where in God's name can you go? And by this time, I've been everywhere else. I've been up and down every avenue there was to alcoholics at that time. I had been through the doctors and the nurses, and I've been through the farms and the sanitariums and the bosses and the politicians and the money and the jobs. And Stephanie kept me going, really, because there was no one else would have much to do with me. And so I drank, and I drank. And it wasn't as though I didn't know about alcoholism. I knew about alcoholism. What the hell? I knew about it. I remembered my neighborhood in the Bronx. I knew about my family. I'd been to the funerals. I knew what was waiting for an alcoholic like me. I knew what happened to alcoholics. I had seen what happened to alcoholics. And if I gave it any thought at all, I don't think I thought about it much, but if I gave it any thought at all, I guess I thought, well, now it's my turn to die that disgusting, horrible death that they all the others did. And so I drank, and I just drank is all. And then I really, really, as I talk to you now, as I'm just speaking to you now, I did not think that I would ever stop drinking. I just didn't think it was possible. And so I drank. And then one day, my time came. One day. I think that there is a time for all of us. And I think there is a time for each of us. I say to you that there is a line somewhere beyond which we are not permitted to go. And it seems to me that there is a point somewhere below which we are not permitted to sink. And it seems to me that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. I don't know where this line is for you. How would I know? I only know what happened to me. And this is an individual and a personal thing. And I think it is different in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my big brother, Billy. They call one night from the vet's hospital in Minneapolis to say he was dead. He died of alcoholism there. He had collapsed in the streets of Skid Row. They brought him to the vet. And he died the way alcoholics sometimes do, without friends, without family. He was a long, long way from our neighborhood. But I tell you this. My brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. And that's how he stopped. And for other people, it could be something trivial. But that line is there somewhere. And we all come to it in our own time and in our own way. But come to it we must. And I showed up on a day that wasn't so different from so many other days. It was November 24th, 1965. I hadn't had a drink for a couple of days. And I was in this place where I worked, and I had money. I had a recent influx of money. There was a bar in the lobby of the building. So the question was, would I pop down there and say hello to my long-lost friends I hadn't seen in a while? Or should I call a man I knew who had become sober in this program? His name was John, and only through the grace of God this opportunity was given to me, and I called him, and I told him what was going on with me, and he knew me, and he knew of me, too. And he was over to see me in a matter of minutes. God, he looked good. Oh, he looked so good walking in that room, and I felt like crap. And I said to him, how can I be as successful as you are in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? He gave me that look that I was talking to you about yesterday. He was always giving me that look, that sponsor, smarmy, smarter than you are look. And he said, don't drink. And go to a meeting. She'll be all right. Well, I didn't want him to tell me that. And I told him I didn't want. I said, listen, I've been here, you know, I know it. I was here in 63. He went, tell me something else. He said, well, don't drink and go to meetings. That's all you have to know. I said, you understand, see, John, the trouble with you is you don't really understand the problem. And without an understanding of the problem, we're going no place. He said, the real problem here is this place where I work. I should have a better job. Well, he said, if you don't drink and you go to the meetings, you get a better job. See, you don't even understand. I'm in big trouble up at the house. I'm not even, you know, she's really on the warpath up there. Well, he said, if you're not drinking, you go to the meetings, you'll cool off. I said, you know, I'm being sued by a bank about a misunderstanding in a loan application. He said, I think I read about that. Oh, yeah, well, he said, if you don't drink and you go to the meetings, you could probably settle that. I sensed that there was no dialogue there. He was not directing himself to my inner child. Who at this point was a juvenile delinquent. And he made a couple of phone calls, and he said, come on, you're wasting everybody's time around here. And he just took me over to Grand Central, and he stuck me on a train up to Larchmont, New York. It's about a 40-minute ride. And halfway up, I reconsidered, you know. What the hell did I must have panicked to call that idiot. Don't drink, eh? My ass. Wait till this train stops. I sure you don't drink. And when the train stopped and I got off at the Larchmont station, standing on the platform was my mailman, the guy that brought the mail to our house. His name was Al, and he was the chairman of the local AA group. And Al said, "Get in the car." I said, "Al, I don't hang around with mailmen." No offense, I don't hang around with mailmen. He said, "Some guy called me about you from New York. Get in the car." Well, I'm not in a position to have a fist fight with a mailman or anybody else. So I got in Al's car. I said, "Al, I'm up the creek here, Al." "Yeah," he said, "well, don't drink. Go to meet." So if any of you are seeking my advice, because I'm from out of town, which is the definition of an expert, you want some advice, I'll give you some advice. Don't drink. You go to meetings, you'll be all right. Just stop being a pain in the ass to everybody around you. Just go to meetings, don't drink, try to help people. You'll be fine. Don't worry about it. Everything's going to be fine. And I went to, Al took me up to the meeting that night. I haven't had a drink since. But first, of course, I had that day. See, I had that. I was given a day. They made me a gift. John and Al said, "Here, have a day." So I took a day. Who knows, had I not been given that gift that day, who knows what life would have been like. And that John, I was talking about him yesterday, he is some piece of work. I said to him, "How many of these meetings do I have to go to?" "Oh," he said, "based on your obvious intelligence and your terrific background, we think that 7 ought to do it for you in a week. Just go to 7 a week. You'll be all right." I said, "That's every day." He said, "Yes, that's the usual 7 days is a week." "That's right." I said, "That's a lot of time." "Oh, yeah. Well," he said, "you can do it some other way. Now, why don't you just go on the days that you drank?" I said, "I drank every day." He said, "I know." So I was supposed to go to 7 meetings a week, but I don't like people pushing me around, so I went to 9. Right now, I'm still going to 9. Here it is, 29 years later, I'm going to 9 meetings a week. I like AA meetings. I like AA meetings. I like them. I like them. I like them. I like AA people. I like AA meetings. I like AA. And why wouldn't I go? Why wouldn't I go? My God. I was born here. On here. Everything I am, everything I have, everything I hope to be is here. Every single thing, every single thing. Every single thing. I was around months and I had to get that whiskey out of me before I could admit that I was powerless over alcohol. I had to be away from it. You know, when I had it, I wasn't powerless over it. I knew what to do with it. Christ, I could drink any way you wanted. I could drink rub-a-dub under the bridge with you, if that's what you wanted. I'd go to 21 and have a martini and a frosted glass, whatever you say. Somebody said, "What would you like to drink?" And I'd say, "Yes." It's not dilly-dally around. Just put this shit in a glass and I'll drink it. I don't care what you give me. Now, my preference, of course, was vodka because it didn't smell. Especially on the third court. That third court going down smooth, boom, like that. And I found out, as I told you yesterday, that just one day came along and that urge to drink, that desire to drink, that compulsion, obsession, was gone, just like that, just in the twinkling of something. And I have never looked back from there, and I knew that there was a power here in our program, much greater than my own, obviously, since I am without power altogether. There was a power here. I could see it in you. I could see it in this group. I could see it in John. I could see it in Al. I could see it with everyone I associated with. That here were people who had tapped into a source of power, as our book says. They have tapped into a source of power which is unlimited and can do everything for them they could not possibly think of doing for themselves. And we, you and I, are not here because of drinking or not drinking. That isn't the issue. There never was the issue. The issue is my continuing, ongoing relationship with God. Nothing less than God. The power of God is nothing less than that going on here. And it is, as Carl Jung said, I mentioned, Jung said to Bill in his letter, I was not whole. My craving for alcohol was my desire for wholeness, for unity with the force and power of God. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. It is to enable you and me to establish a relationship with God which will see us through every possible part of our lives. Good days, bad days, calamities, births, deaths, firings, hirings. The power is constant. It's there. There's some kind of a plan that I haven't the slightest idea what the plan is, but I know who the planner is. And I have something even more valuable than faith. I have experience. I've seen it. I've seen it in so many lives, and more valuable even, I've seen it in my life. Every single thing that alcoholism took from me, this program has returned to me in ways which are baffling and beyond even my understanding. Every single title, every job, every friend, every position, every dollar, all have been returned to me. I have been a full-time tenured professor of law since 1984. I was a part-time professor of law in two university law schools before I came to Florida. In 1992, I was a distinguished visiting professor of law at the Fordham Law School. And when I went in that summer, they have an office for the visiting professor. And they had one of those yellow pieces of paper that said, about time. About time. So what is it that I can say to you that I haven't said? What is it I can bring to you that I haven't tried to bring? I've done what I have done. I would be remiss if I did not thank Bob and the committee, who the hell it was that had the good judgment to ask me to come by here, goddamn near kill myself. As you know, I'm one of those A members that goes around. When I end, and I'm finally ending, I always talk about a pamphlet that has been very dear to me since the time I've been here. It's called A Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that pamphlet, the author takes, on the very last page, he takes a biblical turn. And he recalls the time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin, Jesus, as to whether or not he was the Messiah. And these two men found the Lord and they walked with him. And one day they stopped him and they said to him, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we have been waiting for, or should we wait for someone else?" And the Lord really did not answer that question. He said to these two men, go back to John and tell John only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the blind see and that the lame walk. And tell John that the deaf can hear and the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them. In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And everyone knows that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my dear, dear sisters and brothers, in Unity Weekend assembled, if you will accept a report from me, I will tell you only what I have seen and only what I have heard. And based upon that personal observation, it seems to me that the blind do see and the lame do walk. And I know that the deaf can hear. And most certainly, the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again through the longest day and into the darkest night the good news of this program brought to the alcoholic who suffers, the poor in spirit. Thank you.